preserving the scriptures, that they're able to preserve them so well after 2,300 years. And it says something about the attitude that especially the Sangha had about the Sutta. Sutta's work kind of holy, it was special, that we had to look after them with special care, and they actually succeeded in that, and that's why we have this record of the teaching of the Buddha even after such a long time. And this particular sutta is one of those core aspects of that. It exists in the Chinese, it exists in many different versions. And also, it is very similar to the seven factors of awakening, the seven samudrangas. Seven samudrangas also are very similar to this. I talked about the factors of awakening very briefly before, and this maps onto the seven factors of awakening very, very well. And I don't know if you remember back to the very first day, of those of you who were here at the very beginning, you may remember we talked about the 37 Bodhipakya Lamas, and being the essence of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha said, well, I passed away, when everything is gone, this is it, this is what you should remember. 37 Bodhipakya Lamas, 7 out of those 37, is the 7 factors of awakening. Sattva, Sambuddhanga. So this kind of fits right into there, what is consider the core, the essence of what the Buddha talked about. So this is a way of just knowing what are the important teachings. So I consider this a fundamental teaching. Sometimes I like to call this dependent liberation, because this is what it is. You have dependent origination, and then you have dependent liberation. Liberation happening dependent on a sequence of factors coming into existence. One thing leading to another one. Dependent liberation. Useful knowledge, liberation depends on things. So what does liberation depend on? This is what the sutra is about. And it's really concerned for the patient practice. Yes?
I think that a lot of the students will also get carried out during the lifetime of the sutra.
They were recorded out, yes? They weren't recorded in writing, because there was no writing at the time. They just memorized it. It was an oral tradition. But remember, India had a very powerful oral tradition, because the oral tradition in India had already existed for over 1,000 years before the Buddha. That was the oral tradition of the Brahmanical scriptures called the Rig Veda and the Upanishads. And these, we know that these were passed down orally with extreme fidelity, almost perfectly, for maybe 1,500 years before the Buddha. So the oral tradition was very, very well developed in Indian culture at that time, and they had this ability to preserve teachings orally over long periods of time. The writing down of the Buddha scriptures only happened, it is said to happen in Sri Lanka in the 4th century BC. So about 300 years maybe after the Buddha, 300 to 400 years after the Buddha, that's when they actually recorded down. But what is interesting here is that, the very school, they separated around the time of Ashoka, so maybe about 100 to 150 years after the Buddha. That was still in the oral period. It was still being transmitted orally, and despite the fact that it was still being transmitted orally, still, when you look at them now, they still are virtually the same. It shows us that oral transmission actually was very faithful. Because that was part of the process still going on at that particular time. Just because it was oral doesn't mean that it was inaccurate. Sometimes oral transmission can be very, very accurate and precise. Okay, sometimes oral transmission also made mistakes. And you can actually see that now. Sometimes you can see those differences between the parties who went from Chinese as they have the hallmarks of being some of the mistakes, some of the differences that look like faults in oral transmission, ancient faults. But they're very few and far between that, and they don't really affect the core message of the Buddha's teachings at all. These are important questions, because it's important to feel and have a sense of confidence that what we have is the real thing. Otherwise, it makes it very hard to, hard to believe what's going on here. But, it is astonishing. This particular sutta, compared to the Chinese, almost exactly the same. And this is despite the fact that they were transmitted separately, or orally, in separate transmissions for a long, long period of time. Anyway, so please ask questions as we go along if you want to. I think that from my point of view, that's perfectly fine there. Anyway, let's read this out. So this is what this sutta sounds like here. Figures, flanks, dignities, lay men and lay women there. For a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no will needs to be exerted, let non-regret arise in me then. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition need be exerted, let joy arise in me then. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no will needs to be exerted, let rapture arise in me then. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no volition, no will needs to be exerted, let my body become tranquil then. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil then. For one tranquil in body, no will need be exerted, let me feel pleasure. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, no volition need be exerted, let my mind be stilled. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is stilled. For one who is stilled, no will need be exerted, let me know and see things according to reality. It is natural that one who is filled knows and sees things according to reality. But one who knows and sees things according to reality, no will need be exerted. Let me be disenchanted, or let me be repelled. It is natural that one who knows and sees according to reality is repelled. But one who is repelled, no will need be exerted. Let me become dispassionate. It is natural that one who is repelled becomes dispassionate. For one who is dispassionate, no will need to be exerted, let me realize knowledge and vision of liberation. It is natural that one who is dispassionate realizes knowledge and vision of liberation. Thus because one stage flows into the next stage, one stage fills up the next stage, for the going from the near shore to the far shore. So there you are. So at this point I usually look into the audience, see if anyone has fallen asleep. Because they are repetitive, yeah? It's just kind of one thing and after the other, that's what people complain, oh, so repetitive. Can we just kind of shorten it down a little bit? What about just the key words that take out all the repetition? And I can understand why people say that. We're not used to this kind of repetition. Yeah? If you write something in the modern day, nobody writes like this anymore. And of course, the reason is precisely because it is an oral tradition. And in oral tradition, this is the easy way of preserving the Dharma. This is why I chose this one. Yeah? So once you get used to this kind of repetition, what happens is that the key words really start to stand out. Yeah? Because every factor here, every kind of paragraph is exactly the same, except for one word. Yeah? You go from rapture to tranquility, etc. That one word kind of stands out, and it makes it very clear what you have to focus on as you go through the sequence. So, yes?
Does this have to go from one stage to the next, or it can skip one stage?
Okay, it has really to go through everything. I'll get back to that in a second. I'll go through all the stages there. So, So this is what this sutta is about. And it, so you can see those things very clearly in all the various stages here. So this is the first thing to remember. Now, it may look boring, but once you kind of get into it, actually, it's actually quite nice and quite beautiful. And the suttas are often like this. Often you come across very repetitive things. And if you find it boring, then just go through it fast. Don't allow yourself to get too bored. That will just destroy the joy of reading this thing. So what is the point of all this? What is actually going on here? What are we looking at here? And what we are looking at here is the the first person experience of meditation practice, yeah? This is the psychology, this is your inner feeling when you go through meditation. When it works for you, this is what happens. Yeah, so the very useful map is a mapping out of the inner experience of meditation when it works. And of course, this is one of those things that the Buddha is so skilled at. He shows us the Buddhist path from different angles. And one of those angles is precisely the inner experience that we're supposed to have. Another angle is the angle where you look at meditation from the point of view of what we are supposed to do. Yeah, this is what you do. This is what the gradual training very often does. So you do this first, then you move on to the next one, and then move down. So you look at these things from different angles, and this is one of the powers of the Buddha, this ability to look at things in different ways. So this is ideally how you're supposed to experience meditation. Very useful, it's like a map, it's like having a guidebook, and then you know whether you are going in the right place or not, whether you're heading in the right direction or not. Without this kind of map, you are at a loss. But here it's very clear what is supposed to happen. In theory it's very clear. In reality, even this is not very clear, because people will read into it. Yeah, they have some experience, they will think that they're there, when maybe they're not. So even then it can be tricky. But at the very least, it gives you some idea what you're supposed to do. These are like little signs, yeah, when you travel from here to, I don't know if you travel from here to Singapore, you get on the highway, yeah, and you see the kind of the signs, heading to Singapore, yeah, 200 kilometers, 150, 100 kilometers to Singapore, and then you kind of know you're in the right direction. You're not going to end up in Bangkok instead of Singapore, yeah, because you know you're heading in the right way. Yeah. So, that's what this is about. What is interesting about this, one of the things that always catches me when I read this kind of sequence, is the incredible emphasis on happy states of mind. Yeah, you start off, and it starts off by, virtue, whatever, and then it has non-regret, yeah? And of course, non-regret is the kind of happiness, at least there's a lack of suffering there. Yeah? And then from non-regret, you have joy. Then you have even more joy coming to rapture. Then you have tranquility of the body, yeah, which is a deep sense of peace, a deep sense of satisfaction. From tranquility you have pleasure, sukha, even more happiness. From the sukha comes samadhi, or stillness. Yeah, I don't call it concentration, because if you call it concentration, as a Ram comes here next time, and he will not be pleased with you if you call it concentration. So call it stillness, much better. Stillness. Then from stillness comes seeing things according to reality. And of course, that is what the Buddhist path really is all about. But what you will notice here is this incredible emphasis on happy states of mind. It's supposed to be joyful. It's supposed to be happy. It's supposed to be peaceful. All these marvelous qualities there. And this is what makes kind of the Buddhist teaching so, to me, such a very powerful and beautiful teachings. Here you are. All those things that you ever wanted in your life, all the things that really matter for us as human beings, they are there for to be attained, to be realized, if we practice in a life like that. Yeah, this is so, wow, this is what meditation is about, yeah? And most people don't realize that this is actually what meditation is about. Most people think that meditation is about pain and suffering, and from pain and suffering, you will have happiness as a consequence. I remember one of the first part of the retreat, we read about the Buddha's biography, how the Buddha reached awakening, and one of the little suttas there was the Prince of Bodhi, Bodhi Raja Kumara Sutta. Prince Bodhi goes to Buddha up and says, "Isn't it the case, Master, or Venerable Sir, that happiness is to be gained through suffering?" And the Buddha replies, "Before my awakening, I too thought that happiness was to be gained through suffering." And that's why the Buddha practiced those ascetic practices, that self-tormenting, for many years, yeah, before he actually reached awakening. Precisely because he too thought that. In other words, it's a natural kind of tendency of the human mind to think that suffering is really required. But here the Buddha is saying the opposite, yeah, that the path of meditation, actually, it is supposed to be one of, and it's a happy one. It doesn't mean that you will always have all this happiness in invocation, but this should be our goal. We should be aiming towards this. We should practice in such a way that this becomes possible. And of course, if you torture yourself too much, you're never going to get anywhere near any of these happiness that we're talking about here. This is such good news. Yeah. We forget that sometimes. The good news of Buddhism, we focus on the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the cause of suffering, yeah, the end of suffering. Even the end of suffering doesn't sound really, okay, is that happy or what is it? The end of suffering, yeah. But this is kind of the opposite. And this is one of the core teachings of the Buddha. It brings out all the happinesses on the Buddha's path. It's such a wonderful, positive, beautiful message. And this is why, one of the reasons why this is so powerful and why I love this kind of sutra so much. And this is a very good guide where, how a meditation should lean. It should always lean towards that, lean to the positive experience. So if you find too much suffering in your meditation, you already know that you're roughly heading in the wrong direction. You're never going to find happiness through suffering. So forget about that. What can you do to reduce the suffering? I'm not saying that there will be, you can have meditation without any kind of suffering. That's impossible. There will always be little problems and little things. That's just the way that, you know, the human mind and the human body work. But generally, there should be a leaning, an inclination towards happiness. You shouldn't be tense, you shouldn't be full of pain, it shouldn't be very problematic for you. If you start in a meditation, you get really confused and angry or whatever, you know that something isn't going right. So stop straight away. Yeah, this meditation is terrible. What is the Buddha talking about? This is horrible. Again, we can handle with the Buddha right now. Already there, you know something isn't going quite right. So you stop yourself, and then you ask yourself where the problem lies. Please keep this in mind, yeah? And this is a very important part of the whole meditation idea. So this is the first thing that always strikes me when I read these things, that the emphasis on happiness, and it's not just here, it's in many, many places in the suttas. So we need to balance this against the view of suffering, otherwise we get the completely wrong idea what Buddhism is about. The other thing which is very interesting here, that you will have noticed, maybe you didn't notice, I'm not sure whether you did notice, but for those of you who have been on my retreats before, you will know everything. You will know every word probably that I'm going to say in the next half an hour or hour or whatever it is, because I always like to emphasize this sutta on retreats. But the other thing which is really interesting here is this idea that no will need be exerted. Yeah, na chetanaya karaniya is the Pali. No, it doesn't actually mean no will need to be exerted. What it actually means is this is not to be done by will. That's what it actually means. Yeah, chetana is the will. Chetana is the intention. This is not to be done by intention, by willing. And the implications of that are very powerful. What it means is that if you start willing, you want to kind of do this, or you start to exert your effort to try to control yourself, to get yourself in the right direction, yeah, all of that is not going to work. This cannot be done through an act of will. In fact, the will just gets in the way. That's kind of the implication of this as well. The will is a problem here. So this is why, when you come to meditation, especially to these deeper stages of meditation, you try to withdraw the will from the meditation practice because it gets in the way. It is not part of the path. In fact, what this says here, it is natural, yeah? It is natural when you have one thing that the next thing will arise. So if it is natural, then it means that it's automatic. It happens by itself. You don't have to make it happen. You just stand back and allow the process to happen. And this is why a lot of meditation practice is to learn to let go of the will. How do you learn that? You learn just to be content, happy whatever is here. You learn to be a passive observer. A passive observer is exactly the opposite of willing, yeah? Passive observer means you are just going with the flow as the flow is. That is what it actually refers to. Yeah? So, and it makes it so easy. Yeah, in theory anyway, it makes it so easy. Yeah? Just stand back, after you sit back, you don't stand so much in meditation, sit back, or maybe you lie back if you are lying down on the floor here, and you just wait, and you see what happens. And if you are ready, if the mind is prepared, then this whole process will happen by itself. I love the way Ajahn Brahm uses meditation. Yeah? He always says, okay, what do you do? Just sit back, yeah, you chill, just relax, yeah? And as you just relax, start off everybody leaning back against the wall, just relaxing, allowing things to calm down, yeah? And as you kind of just calm down, and then eventually things just happen all by themselves. Limitless life, darkness just come. And why does this happen? Well, it happens for someone like Ajahn Brahm. Why does it happen? Because the mind is ready. Yeah? And for most people, it doesn't happen as easily as for someone like Ajahn Brahm, who's incredibly skilled at meditating, or skilled, very well developed, maybe is a better way of putting it, has been doing this for a long time. But the general idea is the same. Yeah? And if the process doesn't actually happen, then we need to ask ourselves why. And we'll talk about this in a second. Why the process doesn't happen? Even though you really relax, you kind of let go, why is it that this process doesn't take place? But it's a wonderful thing that all we have to do is take the will, take the doing out of the equation. Sit back, be content, be happy with whatever is there, be the passive observer. There's nothing you have to do. Yeah, and what a great thing that is, your whole life is spent on doing things, yeah? On kind of forcing things into existence, making things appear. Willpower is such an important part of our life. You're always exerting it to get things done. And, you know, from you're a tiny kid, you get told, work harder at school, yeah, because you can get bread. Okay, you learn how to use willpower from the moment you are, you know, from you're 5 or 4 years old already, you can get told to. And then you continue like that your whole life. And then when you come down to meditate, and you can't let go, it's not a big surprise, yeah? Because this is our whole life is focused around the idea of willpower and intention and agency and getting things done. So suddenly we have to go in the opposite direction. And that is why it is harder. Not because it really is hard, but just because our habits go in a different way. So this shows you how easy meditation really is. Yeah, so easy. Too easy to say in Australia. Too easy, right? No, I can't even say it. They really make fun of me in Australia. I try to pretend to be Australian. I can't even do it. But that's kind of the thing that they say down there. So this is the sequence. Yeah, it's all about not exerting anything, not actually doing anything. Yeah? Now, because this sequence is a sequence that happens automatically, naturally, then to understand how the sequence comes about, yeah, this is kind of one of the important points about this, that how does the sequence come about if it is a natural thing? Well, you have to go back to the very first one, yeah? If everything else is automatic, yeah, well, that's going to happen, you can't really do anything like that. What you can do something about is only the very first part of the sequence. Because that's where it begins. So what that means, the very simple lesson, this kind of lesson I've been talking about all the time, is that you need to act to get that very first one, put that one into place. Yeah? That's what it really means. And what is that first one? Well, we see here, straight from the Buddha says, for one who is virtuous. No volition need to be exerted for a virtuous person. So it is all about virtue, it is all about sila, all about our habits, all about how we live our lives. That is how these things come about, yeah? That is how this process starts. So, you know, always we need to come back to that. We always need to ask ourselves, if this process, it doesn't function, if this thing doesn't happen in our meditation, why? And the reason why is because we need to focus more on our sila. So remember that. It is actually very simple. Yeah? What do we mean by sila? And remember, sila here in Buddhism is very broad, very, very wide. It doesn't refer to just keeping the 5 precepts. It doesn't just refer to that basic sila. It refers to our entire character, the whole way how we live, how we think about the world, how we perceive the world. All of these things is part of this. So when I talk about, you know, you can summarize sila in one word, that's kindness. Yeah? So if you can be kind, and when we talk about kindness, we mean kindness by body, speech, and also by mind. And this is often the area which often is missing, is the mental part of things. Yes, we're able, perhaps able to be reasonably kind by body and speech, But the mind is sometimes get out of control. This is where sometimes we need to put in extra effort to make the mind also positive, to make the mind have a kind of the right outlook, the right way of looking at things. And for this reason, I will talk quite a bit later on about how to deal with the mind, with the thinking mind. This is the sort of teaching that you can be told again and again and again, yeah? Because it takes a lot of effort to deal with the mind, get the mind on the right track. Yeah? I'd be very surprised if there's anyone here who never gets angry. Yeah? If you speak, there's one of you who never gets angry, I'd say, wow, you are doing incredibly well. Yeah? But it's very rare to find a person who never gets upset at all. And basically, you have to have very deep insight to be able to do that. Yeah? There's always something we can do in this area. And this is where we have to focus. This is the real problem. This is the source why this whole process doesn't work. So come back to simple things like that again and again and again. And as you develop these things in the right way, the results will have to happen. Eventually, the joy will come in meditation practice. Some of you may already have experienced some joy in meditation. Yeah, if you have been doing this for a while then. But you can improve that. Sometimes you find you reach like a plateau, yeah, you come to a point and it doesn't go any deeper. To make it go deeper, what you have to do? Go back to the beginning of the process. Ask yourself, what more can I do to purify myself even more? Then you're boosting that power at the bottom and the whole process goes deeper in the future. This is how this works out. It makes the whole thing simple. It is something, is it the message that we find throughout the suttas everywhere? That all meditation practice is conditioned, is caused by our ability to have the right attitude, the right personality, the right habits, the right character. Yeah, you have to have a good character, basically. You have to have a good heart. If you have a good heart, then these things are going to happen. It's nice to have a good heart anyway. It feels good. Yeah? It's a win-win. You look at it already, and also the meditation improves. It's really, it's a good deal. Okay, so that is the starting point. And the other thing, of course, which is interesting here, is also the end point. And the end point of this particular sequence, here I've taken it all the way to the end, is knowledge and vision of liberation. This is the end of the path. When you become an arahant, when you're finally fully liberated, that is the purpose of this. And you will see that part of that process in the middle there. You have the stillness of the mind. Yeah, the samadhi is part of this. And sometimes that is also explained as samadhi. The samadhi is part of this process, part of the thing that we have to go through on the way to liberation. And you see this again, and again, something very, very common in the suttas, that we see this whole process going in this way, through all these things. So, this is the sequence. And now let's have a look at this sequence. Maybe we can answer the question about whether you can skip some of these steps. Is there any particular one you'd like to skip? No? Okay. Well, that one doesn't sound so bad. I'd like to skip that one. Like, for example, the one about repulsion, or revulsion. That would be nice to skip, Don't want to be too repelled, so maybe if you can go straight from samadhi to kind of liberation, that would be nice. Or something like that. Maybe we can skip the, what else is nice to skip? Let's just skip the non-regret, that sounds pretty bland. Just go straight to the joy. But if you understand how this process works, actually, all of these steps are really required and they happen naturally. And all of these steps are positive anyway. So let's see how they actually work out. So when you live well, when you are virtuous, you don't have any regrets. It's pretty obvious. Yeah, you don't think back, oh, I should have done that, so you don't have any regrets. So this is the first benefit. They're already very useful, but it's not just that you don't have any regrets. Yeah? It is also that you actually start to feel good about yourself. And this is one of these things that you find in the suttas. One of the things that you see in many places is how do we give rise to that initial joy that actually makes the path work out. And one of the ways of doing that is the recollection of our seed. collection of our habits, a collection of our morality. This is one of the ways of actually giving rise to joy. So sometimes we can deliberately sit back and we can just ask ourselves, well, how am I living my life? Yeah? And you can maybe even think of specific situations where you did something nice. But just also the general idea, how am I living my life? Just by recalling that, if you really live well, you can feel kind of happy about yourself. You feel, yeah, I'm living well. I'm doing good things. I'm being kind to other people, doing the right thing. And then you feel uplifted just by the sense of the idea that you're living well. This has nothing to do with ego. It's not, yeah, I'm the best. Yeah, these other people, they're no good. If you think like that, of course, it's not going to work. Yeah. But it's like a quiet satisfaction with how you live. Yeah, it's not nothing that you boast about to other people. It's just quiet satisfaction inside of you. Yeah, you're living well. And you feel good about that. So this is part of the non-regret. It's not just that you don't have deliberately, you know, bad thoughts about yourself, you actually feel the exact opposite. And sometimes the regret that we have is often maybe not verbalized. Yeah, it's not like, yeah, I did something bad, I should have done that. Sometimes it's almost simply as if your mind is kind of a bit darker, yeah, a bit more grey, a bit more, you're losing a bit your energy somehow, you know, you don't feel that energy inside it. It's almost as if you it's like you're dragging yourself down a little bit. Sometimes it doesn't, not necessarily that you're blaming yourself, it's just that you there's a general feeling of not feeling good about yourself. And this is what I was talking about before, right? For those of you who are here, we're talking about dependent origination. Yeah? This is exactly what dependent origination shows us as well. If you do something bad, something wrong in the world, you say something which isn't quite nice, or you do an act, or even sometimes just thinking, if you think something which isn't quite right, then how do you feel at that point? And if you look into your mind, you will see it is never a pleasant thing, even just thinking something bad about someone else, let alone doing something bad. It's almost straight away, you lose a bit of energy. You lose a bit of brightness inside. Something is gone. Something is missing. Yeah? And that, in a sense, is part of the thing we're talking about, regret. The fact that you're darkening your mind, reducing the energy, reducing the brightness, reducing all these good qualities inside of us. You come kind of bad going down. And of course, the exact opposite happens. If you act kindly, if you act with kindness, the exact opposite happens. You actually feel straight away kind of energizing, yeah? You get energized, you feel more bright, you feel more happy as a consequence, straight away. If you have even just a kind thought about somebody else, you can often see the effect of the mind right there. You feel a little bit of energy coming into your mind. But this is what we mean by regret and non-regret, this kind of general effect that has on the mind. And try to notice that in your life. If you can notice this general sense of how our intentional actions affect our mind directly, it is a very powerful incentive and motivation to live better. Because you realize that it actually affects it so much. Each one of us, we are affected by our own actions, our own intentions. So powerful here. Doing it the right way, and you are gradually lifting yourself up. You're adding more and more and more, accumulating all the energy, accumulating all the brightness and lightness in the mind, and lifting yourself up. And this is how this process then happens, and it starts to take off. So it's a wonderful thing, and we need all the motivation and all the help we can to be able to practice this life, because it's not always easy. It's very easy to fall back into old habits, to allow the external environment to control us or to condition us. It makes it much harder to practice this. So noticing these things actually is very, very useful. Even though you think that maybe the other person deserves to be called off, well, you don't deserve the result of that. Yeah? So if you just don't deserve the result of that, don't do it. If you're going to tell someone off, then don't really tell them off. Be kind for them and be compassionate. Try to consider it more as a help rather than as a telling off. And then it is happening in this way. So from Sila comes non-regret, or From sila comes the opposite of regret, comes the uplifting of the mind instead. Vipatisara is a Pali word. So abhipatisara is no regret. Now, if you have no regret, then joy happens, and you can't avoid it. Joy has to happen if you have no regret. That's what it said there. It is natural that joy arises without regret. The more non-regret you have, the more obvious, the easier it is for the joy to arise. So the sila is in place. No regrets, nothing bad. And then when you think back on your life and feel well, you feel a gladness in your heart. Samudra is the Pali word here. It's the beginning of this whole path of meditation comes about. You feel glad. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, what does this mean? Well, it's like, you know, suddenly you just kind of, you know, you think back and you just feel light. You feel bright. You feel glad about your life. Something that happens on the strangest times, You just don't know. Suddenly the conditions come together and you feel a sense of gladness about yourself, of joy about yourself. Walking down the street and suddenly you just feel really light and happy again. Yeah, it's hard to sometimes know exactly when the conditions come together, when the time is right, when there comes the time, and this is a bit like that. You know, often we can't make it happen, it happens when the time is right. Maybe on this retreat, maybe you will feel a little bit of that joy and happiness if the conditions are right. That's really all it is, the gladness of the mind. You feel good inside, uplifted. And from that, gladness, from that, we have rapture, it says here. Rapture in Pali is piti. Piti is an even deeper sense of happiness. And at this point, this often happens. It can happen in daily life, but this normally happens more in meditation practice. When you sit down, when you are peaceful, and sometimes it can be like, happiness, it is both in the mind, it can also often be felt in the body as well. We can feel kind of waves, like a wave of pleasure going through the body, So it can be felt in different ways. So it's a very powerful, very strong feeling. And now you start to feel really, really happy at this particular point. And of course, what is going on here, because you are really enjoying what is happening, the mindfulness also has become very stronger. You know, you're not going to think about the past and the future very much. If you feel so much happiness in the present moment, your mind will be drawn to the present moment. You will be here. So, this is one of those things that you see in the sutras, three things that kind of revolve around each other. Mindfulness, energy, and piti, or pamuja, gladness. They revolve around each other, because when these things tend to be present at the same time. The mind gets energized, and when the mind is energized, that's when it's also easy to follow the breath, it's easy to be present, all of these things kind of come together around this. So the piti can be experienced in many different ways. It often has a physical component. It doesn't have to have a physical component. It can also be a purely mental one, but it can occur in many different ways. What is the difference between joy and rapture? And it's really just a different intensity of feeling. One kind of naturally goes over it into the next one. And you're starting to feel all this happiness. As you do that, so now we are coming into the meditation properly here, Now you're watching the breath, or you're doing your metta practice, or whatever it is, and these things come about as a consequence. So, when you have piti, you continue watching the breath, you continue watching, doing this metta, or whatever it is, and as you do that, things start to calm down. The piti can be quite exciting, it can be quite, wow, this is really powerful, but then you start to calm down, and you become more peaceful, and the happiness is still there, but it's a more peaceful kind of happiness. In some way, that peaceful kind of happiness is even more powerful, even stronger, even better, and you're starting to feel very settled. It's like it comes a point, and this is what I mentioned the other day, it comes a point when you don't want to do anything else, but just sit right here. You don't want to go anywhere else. This is what tranquility really means. The body, everything, you are so content, so happy, that you start feeling it like a rock. You are this rock sitting here, not moving anywhere, not going anywhere, completely still, immobile. And it feels like you could sit here forever. That's what it feels like. And the body is absolutely solid. And I was telling the story, those of you who weren't here for the first 5 days, telling the story, this was from Thailand. This was when Ajahn Brahm was a young monk in Thailand. Ajahn Brahm always had very good meditation, yeah, always been a very good meditator. Yeah. And one day they all would do the meditation together. So you have the monks in the hall, the lay people would be in the hall. And one day, because Ajahn Brahm was such a good meditator, he was sitting on the stage there, and one of the lay women was watching him, yeah. And she's watching him hour after hour. Yeah, and he would sit there absolutely still, like no movement at all, quite literally. You know, there comes a point when your meditation is so deep that you stop breathing, essentially. Yeah? Even if you don't stop completely, it's very, very close to stopping completely. Yeah? And after a while, this woman got worried. Yeah? She looks at this rock sitting there. Is this a human being? Was it a sculpture? Not sure anymore after a while. But she goes out and she tells the other monks that were outside, "Oh, there's a monk sitting on the stage there inside the hall. He's dead. Yeah, he must be dead. He's not moving at all. He's like a corpse. Sitting completely, utterly still, no movement." And this is one of the signs, yeah, of deep meditation, of tranquility, of pasadi is the Pali word here. That you feel so settled that you don't want to do anything else in the whole world. It feels like you could sit here forever after that. This is where you're starting to come to what I would call the experiencing, the meaning of life itself. Yeah, well, because you're starting to feel that you have found something which you don't need to go anywhere else. You don't want to go any further. There's no need to do anything more than this. And of course, if you don't want to go any further, then that's it. You found the meaning. You found the answer to everything else. So this is like pure happiness, pure pleasure, pure contentment in the present moment. Nothing else you want to do in your whole life, that's tranquility. And that's not the end. Yeah. It may sound like the end, but it's not the end. It goes beyond that. When you feel this kind of tranquility, with that tranquility, is an even more subtle kind of happiness. The happiness of that tranquility, called sukha in Pali, a very subtle, beautiful, present moment awareness that arises. Nothing to do with your body anymore. Now, it's like you're just in your mind. And as you are in your mind, the power of happiness will draw you into the present moment even more. Everything becomes completely still. All you are interested in is that particular happiness. So from that happiness comes the samadhi. Yeah? Samadhi, the stillness of the mind. Because all you're interested in is that particular happiness. Everything else becomes irrelevant. So you focus 100%. Stillness, samadhi, concentration is called here, but please don't say concentration. If you do, then I will get in trouble because Ajahn Brahm will say, "What? You just say the word concentration when you were in KL last time?" Because I hear people talking using this word. Why is concentration so bad? Because concentration usually implies willpower. You're forcing yourself onto an object. Stillness is much better. It doesn't imply that. Then the samadhi comes, absolutely focused on the object, yeah? And then, at this point, your mind is 100% purified. No more defilements, nothing else going on. Pure happiness, moment after moment, hour after hour of pure happiness. This is what samadhi is all about. It's almost too good to be true, isn't it? How is it possible to have pure happiness, hour after hour, with no movement, nothing happening yet? And this is kind of what the Buddhist teaching is about. Reminds me of a place in the suttas where the Buddha, he was arguing with or discussing with some Jains about pure happiness. The Buddha was claiming, "I experience much more happiness than the king of the country." And these Jains, they wouldn't kind of believe that, they wouldn't kind of listen to him. And the Buddha said, "Well, is it possible for the king of Magadha, King Bimbisara, to sit for 7 days and experiencing nothing but pure bliss for 7 days continuously?" And they said, "No, of course not. Of course that isn't possible. If you're the king, you can barely have a single moment of pure bliss, let alone 7 days." But of course, the implication is that if you practice meditation, you can have these kind of things. So much better to be a meditator than to be the king of the Magadha, according to this particular sutta. So samadhi, yeah, samadhi then has the ability, it empowers the mind, it makes the mind very powerful because of the stillness, because of the taken away of all the defilement, because it's a very powerful place, it's a very powerful mind that we come to. Them. And this mind is then the mind that enables you to see things according to reality. You have to have that mind first of all. But yes, please, yes.
Somebody that you're talking about is a stimulus to the Samatha meditation where they talk about you reach a state of concentrated mind.
What?
And then
yes.
You achieve the various levels of jhana.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah.
Because that one, the various states of jhana, you actually suppress the defilements and it's not uprooted. That's the reason why. That's why they have this thing called Vipassana meditation, where it's a different approach.
Yeah.
The traditional Samatha meditation was started by the Hindus, and you know, you suppress and then you have concentrated mind, and then you suppress all the defilements, and then you achieve jhana, breathe, blah blah blah. But the defilements is still stuck inside your mind.
Yeah.
They say, and then you have Vipassana, which is a different approach where you uproot the defilement. Can you?
Sure, I can. Yeah, I haven't finished the sequence yet. This is actually coming further down the sequence. So because we haven't talked to the end yet, that's the reason why I haven't talked about it yet. So, but the way, first of all, I don't like the word suppression, because the idea of suppression has the sense of holding something down. Yeah, you suppress something, it means that you use force to hold it down. But that is not what is happening here. What is happening here is that the defilements are initiated from the mind, temporarily eliminated. Not suppressed, but temporarily eliminated. They're not held down, but they're suppressed. It gives the feeling that they're still there, kind of under the surface. So they're not actually there at all anymore. They're completely gone at that point in time. And then they come back again later on, through cause and conditions. So the suppression is the wrong idea, and it's not what is happening here. It's actually a temporary elimination. It's a much better way of looking at it. Yeah? It actually makes a big difference, because one has a sense of force about it, but the other one is actually much more easy way of understanding this. But the point is that to be able to permanently eliminate the hindrances or defilements, first of all, we have to temporarily eliminate them. And the reason for that is because insight can only happen when the hindrances are not present. If you have hindrances in the mind, it is impossible to eliminate, to have insight. And it is insight that actually abandons the hindrances and the defilements, finally, in the end. Insight is the path, yeah? So when we talk about insight, I mean, I don't like the word vipassana, because I don't think it actually means insight. I think it means clear seeing or something like that. By understanding the three characteristics, the five khandhas, in terms of the three characteristics, that is how the hindrances and the defilements are abandoned. And the reason for that is that it's not very hard, it's not so hard to understand. Because remember, the part of the insight is the insight into non-self. They are a very, very important part of this. As long as you have a sense of self, the defilements will tend to arise. Why? Because the sense of self, by definition, includes attachment. Why does it include attachment? I've talked about this before here already. But you were here the first part, were you? You were here for the first part, yes? Is that right? No, okay. Yeah. So basically, when you have a sense of self, you are defining, you have, there are certain aspects of you that you, that sense of self relates to. Yeah, the sense of self is an attachment. So that thing which you take to that sense of self, that you have to attach to by definition, because it is your identity. So the sense of self is content, because it is content, that content, whether that is your consciousness, your will, or whatever it is, you have to attach to that, because that is what you take to be your very identity. So as long as you have a sense of self, you will attach. As long as you attach, you are guaranteed that you will have desires and aversions and anger. Because once those attachments are challenged, and they always will be challenged in the world, then that is when you will react emotionally to defend those things. So this is why the only way to overcome, finally overcome defilements completely, is actually through deep insight into the five khandha that's being affected by the three characteristics. Only then is it possible to overcome the defilements. So it's like a roundabout way of overcoming defilements. First of all, you overcome them temporarily. Then the mind is powerful enough to have deep insight. Then, through the deep insight, permanent eradication of the defilements after that. Yeah? You cannot, as long as you have defilements in the mind, you cannot overcome the defilements. Yeah? Permanently. You have to do it temporarily first, then you can do it permanently afterwards. So it doesn't mean that you cannot have insight before samadhi. You can have some degree of clarity and insight before samadhi, but the main purpose of insight before you get to samadhi is the insight into how to abandon the defilements and hindrances temporarily. That is the main purpose. Yeah? Which can mean some understanding of impermanence, yeah, because that helps you to abandon the defilements temporarily. If you have, for example, if you see the impermanence of the world, you have less attachment to the world, you have less desire. So by seeing things clearly, by using some degree of vipassana, you will lower the hindrances. But the purpose of both samatha and vipassana, before you get to samadhi, the main purpose is actually just to abandon the hindrance temporarily. Then, when you get to samadhi, then you can have a personal emulation of the things. So, the Satipatthana practice, essentially, if you look at the Satipatthana Sutta carefully, it is all has to do with overcoming defilement and hindrances. That is what Satipatthana is all about. Then, from Satipatthana, then you get samatha, samadhi happening. You happy with that? Yeah, reasonably. Please come back later on. Yeah, if you're not fully happy with what I'm saying, that's fine. And so please just keep on asking if you wish it. And just maybe think about it a little bit, and then come back at some stage if you wish it. I don't mind if people disagree with me. That's perfectly fine. And in the end, if you end up disagreeing, that's no problem at all, as far as I'm concerned, but I'm quite happy to discuss this thing a little bit as well. It's important that we'll discuss, because often that is a way of getting things out properly, understanding. Yes? I think you have to get the microphone. Yes, yes.
Just trying to get the point home.
Yes.
You would think that with a temporary elimination of our defilements,
yes,
it will then help us to get to samadhi.
Yep.
And with samadhi only, we can have permanent abandonment of our defilements.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So that's the two steps.
That's the two steps, Exactly. That's exactly what I was saying. Yeah. Okay. So let us continue. Let's go to the last few steps of the sutta. Now we get into really, really high stuff. Yeah, this is kind of the very end of the Buddhist path, going all the way to Arahant Chakra. But it's nice to, I like to go through this text because it kind of shows us the whole way, all the way to the very end. Don't need to worry too much about this, unless your meditation is really, really good, but just as kind of to keep at the back of your mind, this is part of the map that leads to final and full awakening. Yeah. So once you have stilled your mind in this sense, you don't need any will. Let me know and see things according to reality. I think according to reality is a slightly preferable translation than seeing things as they really are. Because things as they really are, it sounds like things are permanent. Of course they're not. You're just seeing things according to reality. This is what I meant, where I said just a second ago, still samadhi leads to seeing things as they really are. Now this is the real vipassana, if you like it. This is the real clear seeing, to see things according to reality. Before you have samadhi, you cannot see things according to reality. This is what this is saying here. You have to have samadhi first. Only then is that possible. Prior to that, it's going to be a lower kind of vipassana, which has more to do with, as I said, abandoning defilements. Only at this point is it possible to see things according to reality. And this is why, the question often arises, is it possible to become a stream entry, for example? Is it possible to have a true insight into the Dhamma without samadhi? And this really gives you the answer. It is impossible. Yeah? And that is the cause. That is the foundation upon which you do become a stream entry, or any kind of Aryan stage. It happens through samadhi itself. So seeing things like what in reality is exactly what street entry is about. So what does it mean to see things like what in reality? That is what we were just talking about before. It means seeing yourself, looking inside of yourself, seeing your body and mind, and see, in other words, the five khandhas is just our experience, yeah, right here and right now, and seeing that experience in terms of the three characteristics, seeing its impermanence, seeing how it is changing, seeing how it comes to an end, it ceases, seeing the suffering, yeah, how do you see the suffering? Well, you see the whole process, you're calming down, you become happier and happier, and the less there is there, the more happy you are. The less there is the five aggregates, the more happy you are, which means that it aggregates, they are fulfilled. And also you see non-self at the same time. As you go through this whole sequence, you see that the less there is of you there, the more things calm down, the happier these things are. The more you let go of these things, and when they cease completely, you know they can't be you. So you understand, according to reality, how all of this is not self as well. And something is completely gone, the body is completely gone in samadhi, you know the body comes to you, because it's completely gone. So something which can be completely let go cannot possibly be you. So when you see things according to reality, one of the things that you see is you understand the dukkha of existence, of experience. Because you see the dukkha of experience, that is why Nibbida arises. Nibbida here translates as a disenchantment. But in the sutta, it often has a much stronger emotional force than that. It's more a sense of kind of being repelled. Oh, I can't bear this anymore. It's just too much. Yeah? It's a very powerful incentive to let go when you see dukkha. Nobody wants to hold on to dukkha. Nobody wants to hold on to things that are inherently very difficult. So because of that, the moment you see this, oh, you are repelled by it. Because you are repelled by it, you let it go. That repulsion then leads to this, to the dispassion. Dispassion is the dying down of craving. You cannot crave for what is dukkha. So eventually, if you keep on doing this again and again and again, craving eventually disappears. Because craving for dukkha is not an option. You only crave for happiness. Your mind turns towards the happiness, the nibbana, the extinguishment of all things. That is where true happiness is found. And when you do that, you're eventually liberated from craving, liberated from suffering. And you know that you are liberated. And this is what that very last bit here is about. Yeah, I'm not liberated. Happiness. This is the very last part here. So, maybe we can go into a little bit more detail about those things that are probably interesting. We'll see how things, what happens. And then the Buddha said, thus bhikkhus, thus bhikkhunis, thus everyone. One stage flows into the next stage. One stage fills up the next stage. For going from the near shore to the far shore. If you want to go from the near shore, that's where we are now, we're on the near shore now. Because you want to go across the stream and go to the far shore. This is how you cross that stream. And you gradually fill up one thing. And the main thing that you fill up here is the very first one, the virtue, the sila. And then if you keep on filling up the virtue of the sila, that eventually you become liberated. That's what this is saying. Yeah, go back to the beginning, go back to the basic answer, and eventually you become free. Liberation doesn't sound good. The implication of liberation is that if you're not liberated, you are in prison. Yeah. This is kind of the implication of this. You don't know that you're in prison. This is a kind of a weird thing about it. It's like this fish in water doesn't know it is in water in the same way. You don't know that you're in prison. And for one day, you are liberated from it. Wow, that was prison. Now I understand that. This is kind of how I don't mind what the talks about this. Yes, sir.
I just want to
say,
you mentioned that keeping the day really up in terms of anicca, dukkha, and anatta.
Yeah.
That's what you just mentioned.
Yeah.
But how do you see oneself?
How do you see oneself? You see, the way you see non-self is that you, talk about this later on, because later on I will go through the Avatamasattva Sutta, and there it is quite clear what is happening when you go through that. But what you see is that you see in this process, you see things disappearing. Yeah, you see things passing away. For example, you get into samadhi, the body is completely gone. Then it actually sees it. It's completely gone. It's as if you have no attachment. You haven't got all attachment to the body. It's as if you never had a body. The body has become completely irrelevant to you. Yeah? When the body is gone, I don't just mean that it is temporarily disappears. All attachment to it is temporarily gone. Because the only way we can make it temporarily disappear is by abandoning all desire and attachment for that body. At that point, when that happens, you come out afterwards, you realize the body cannot have anything to do with the self. So it was completely gone. I'm still here. There's something else. I can let it go completely. It obviously has its own nature. It goes according to its own thing. Whether I'm aware of it or not, the body kind of goes according to its own condition and phenomena. When that is completely gone, you realize the body is not self. Yeah? Fully and absolutely. Same thing happens with the will. Going into a deep state of meditation, it is completely still. Yeah? To be able to go into that state, you have to actually abandon the will at a particular point. When you abandon the will, when you let go of it, you are letting go of the will. You realize that that will is something which actually is beyond your control at that particular point. You have given it up completely. It is not something that can have anything to do with you. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to give it up completely. At that point, you realize that the will itself is the non-self. Yeah, this is how you have, this is one way of understanding non-self. This is not the only way. Another way is to go into a deep state of samadhi, like we're just talking about now. The deeper the samadhi, the more powerful it's going to be. And then understand how all of these things, how they emerge and come into existence due to causes and conditions. You understand, for example, that the state of samadhi itself is produced by a certain process. This is the process that produces that samadhi. It is produced, in other words, ultimately, it is produced by certain causes and conditions coming together. Once those causes and conditions are no longer there, the samadhi will disappear. So that samadhi itself is not something you can control. It's not something that will always be there. It comes and it goes. It also explains the non-self nature of samadhi. If it was a true self, you would be able to grasp onto it and hold on to it and have it as a permanent reality in your life. But you can't do that. It comes and goes according to causes and conditions. This is another way of looking at it. This is more like an indirect way. The more direct way is to see things ceasing. And see things ceasing is a very direct way of understanding oneself. Yes, I wonder where you were. Okay, yes.
When is the first part just like Anavada Sutta?
It's very similar to Anavada Sutta. Yeah? But I think it goes a bit deeper than that. I think it also includes the Abhyasika Sutta. Yeah? So, and this is a good point because in the gradual training, and this is what I was mentioning before, that in the sutta, there's many different places where they talk about the kind of happiness that you get through the practice. And in the gradual training, you talk about anavata sutta, which means the happiness of blamelessness. Vajra is a thought, anavata is faultlessness, sukha happiness, so the happiness of being faultless or blameless. And then that happiness in the next step becomes the abhyaseka sukha. Abhyaseka means like unmixed happiness. Yeah, and the reason it's unmixed is because even though you are blameless, if you still have some defilements in the mind or some bit of anger and desire, it will color, it will taint that happiness, it won't be pure. So the abhyaseka sukha, the unmixed happiness, the untainted happiness, is a happiness that comes from being blameless, but also having very few defilements in the mind at the same time. Then happiness becomes better. And that is really, I think, what we're talking about here, because here we're talking about the happiness which is actually, you have a very high degree of purity, yeah? The higher that purity, the more powerful that happiness and joy is going to be, So, you must be quite right, there's a very close connection here between these things. That's a very important point. Okay. Yeah, so that is this amazing sutta. It's amazingly kind of good news, yeah? That's what we call the New Testament sometimes. the good news. But this is even better news than the New Testament. I apologize, I've probably been rude to anyone. This really is good news. And this is the kind of thing that when I read the scripture, I really kind of, this is so powerful and so joyful and such a positive thing. Yeah, and even as a Brahman, he said that he had some of his greatest insights in meditation and Buddhism on reading his kind of sutra. So this is sutra on volition, or maybe it should be called the volition of the that's what it really is pointing to. Any last question before we take a break? Yes, over here. Yeah, please. Okay.
Here, 11 processes, right?
Yeah.
To me, the first two of wickedness and one regret is
more
kind of personal nature. If using these two processes that we have, if we do meditation, would the following 9 processes develop on its own, or we need to be cognizant of them so that it becomes a step process?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The reason why we are teaching with these things is just so that you are aware. It's like you have a map, And when you have a map, you know whether you're heading in the right direction or not. This is what this is really about. This tells you, this is where you want to go, so when you do your meditation practice, you know whether you're heading in the right way or not. You know how deep you go. So you don't really create these things. If the way you create this thing, as you might say, you go back to the first two steps, and you create it through your general way of living. That's how we create the whole sequence. It comes out from your character, from our way of living. That's actually where it comes from. So the creation happens at the very beginning, and then the rest is just a process. You just observe it what is happening. And if you see that it's got somewhere down the track, well then you know that actually I want to go even deeper, because the sutta tells you you're supposed to be able to go even deeper. How do you go deeper? Go back to the beginning and ask yourself, how can you purify yourself even more? And as you do this, gradually, the thing develops. Is that what you're asking? Roughly? Yeah? Okay.
So it becomes a roadmap for us.
It's a roadmap for you, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, it's like a map, yeah. Yes.
My question is actually very important. I was just asking, what further from there? During the Indian meditation, I think it was in this subject, my joy tranquility, pleasure, and stillness. That was that junior recipient. Is it a very fast process or?
It can be fast, it can be slow. It really depends on the situation. Usually it's slow. Usually it takes a long time. Yeah, for most people, because the mind takes us down gradually. But it also depends on how long you've been meditating, how you develop your mind. It depends on all these kind of factors coming together in there. But often it can be slow. It also depends on how long you've been on the retreat for now. But the more skilled you are, in a sense, in understanding your mind, the more developed the mind is, the faster you can go. Yeah, so it depends. Sometimes if you are very peaceful and still already on retreat, you can go into samadhi. If you are very, very skilled, you can go into samadhi almost like that. Yeah, this happens. You don't even have to watch the breath, just direction you into samadhi. But that is kind of, it helps to be a sleep mentor at least, or maybe in other hand, that really helps. And it's very, very fast. But don't expect, the trick here is to be patient. Yeah, this is really the trick. And if you are able to be patient, then this process will happen gradually. Sometimes it can take hours for this to happen. That's why patience is so important.
Yes, I experienced that I accept my limits, I
balloon up, expanding it, you kind of feel like you're ballooning up, you don't have any feelings, but very common experiences in meditation practice, that the body kind of feels unusual and strange. It's very, very common. And very often it doesn't mean very much. Or it can be a positive thing, yeah. Very often it is a positive thing, yeah. Because you're letting go of the body a little bit, you experience the body in a new way that you haven't experienced it before. Yeah. So it doesn't really matter. Not worry so much about that. It's just a perception in the mind. But instead, focus on whether your mind is in a good place. If you feel comfortable, if you feel at ease, if you feel relatively calm and tranquil, and the defilements are kind of going down, yeah, that is what really matters. So know if you are in a positive state of mind. If you are in a positive state of mind, that whether your perception of the body is like the body is large or voluminous, all this kind of stuff, it is kind of irrelevant. Just leave that to one side. Go back to the breath. Go back to my meditational gestures. Stay with us, and we'll get new perceptions. There's an interesting story. This is what Anand Shah apparently said about his meditation experience. And he said that once he was meditating, and he had the perception that his body exploded. You know that one?
Yeah.
His body exploded, and then all his intestines, all this kind of inner thing just exploded out. And they were kind of hanging off the trees around there. Yeah? So he had his intestines hanging over there, some of the liver hanging over here, that sort of thing. Yeah? And that also is part of perception. Yeah? It's just something that happens during the meditation experience. I've never heard of anyone else having it, so I don't think you have to be too concerned. It sounds scary, because it sounds a bit scary. But so these are the things that happen in meditation practice. Don't worry about that. It's the mind playing around, the mind playing tricks on us. And people have all kinds of experiences at that particular point, where the start to become calm, when the mind starts to become powerful. Leave it to one side. Go back to the main meditation option.
I had a right back to the concentrating on the breath of God. But I was doing that long kind of lost my body.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I got totally everything.
Yeah.
He was very beautiful. Yeah. Everything was so beautiful. The house was so beautiful. The food was so delicious. The food looked so great.
Yeah.
I never got that experience ever.
Yeah.
But that was at the end of the retreat, the last day.
So forget about it. Just remember it. This is just the memory. This is just something that gives you some insight and understanding what the path can give you. But just let it be. Yeah? Just be happy. Whatever you can get in the meditation, even if you can be a bit peaceful, be happy with that. Don't pray. Be content with what you have. Focus on the causes rather than the results. You need to let go of that experience completely. Yeah? Completely. Yeah? Forget about it. Enjoy what you have. And then you will come back again eventually. Yeah? So causes are always a trick. Focus on the results, you can destroy the results. Focus on the causes and the results will eventually come back again. I know it's very hard. I know there's so many people who say this, yeah. You're not the only one. They're just so kind of confident. Oh, I just want the first thing and say, can't get it back yet. You're not supposed to get it back yet. Yeah, forget about that. Pretend that you're never going to get it back in your whole life. Then the craving will be gone. Yeah? You're not supposed to get it back. It will come back if you don't not supposed to get it back. That's what it comes back. It's a paradox. Yes.
Ajahn, have you thought in other religions that Hindus and Christians have inherited in order to use other beliefs of God? Like, as universal. I mean, that is peaceful that someone can,
yeah,
according to themselves, that feels that can feel the higher self or the God. And if these things are happening naturally, like what Buddha said, one stage leads to another stage, why the only feel I am God? Because they don't feel beyond me, that they feel that they are holding that contraction in the gut, always trapped in the gut. They won't go beyond that. I think that it's in the so that's my because I have no sound of very yoga, good language, yet to have the feeling I'm the guru, I with my universe, so I'm the consciousness. But to me, I know that is beyond that, but to them, I think it's that ego, I don't think ego, is it that? Perception is always there as unimportant. That's my question. But I never argue with that.
And this is the genius of the Buddha, because the Buddha also lived in that kind of culture where they had an idea of the ultimate. They talk about drama and atma. Yes, they already had an idea of time of the Buddha. But the Buddha wasn't really satisfied with that. He wanted to see things. He wanted to kind of investigate this whole idea of whether it was true or not. So when the Buddha got the state of samadhi, instead of kind of reading things into the state, this is what is really happening here. You're reading things into the state that aren't necessarily there. You just look at the state and say, well, what is there? Well, I feel unified. I feel happiness and pleasure. I feel all of these kind of things. But I cannot deduce from that that this is God. And how can you deduce that? You're not actually experiencing God. What you are experiencing, you're experiencing certain qualities. And then you are interpreting those qualities as if they are God, as if they are universal consciousness, and all these kind of things. So the view that you have at the outset is what then this makes you interpret the experience you have in a certain way. And that is why the Noble Eightfold Path always begins with right view. If you haven't got right view to begin with, then you're going to have wrong samadhi, because your samadhi will be interpreted in the wrong way. That's why right view is so hard. That's why it's so good to have the Buddha here, because you have already set things out clearly. This is the radical nature of the Buddha. He's able to kind of go beyond the ordinary human conceptions and look at things in an even deeper way. And that is kind of what is happening there. Okay, yes.
Further from what you just mentioned.
Yeah.
About reading God and some go further say that, oh, yes, the soul is unified to the universal one, universal consciousness.
Yeah.
So are you saying that Buddha doesn't believe in it?
What I'm saying is that the reason why they interpret this as God is because they have a certain conception of God to begin with. God is oneness. God is love. God is the sense of self being God. God, all these things, unity, all this kind of thing. And when they come to the Dharma, they think, wow, this has all the characteristics of God, so this must be God. But they are going beyond the evidence. Yes, it has all of these characteristics. But then to say it is God is actually going beyond the evidence that is there. That is what I'm saying here. You're okay with that? Does that make sense? Yeah? That's, yeah. Yes, I'm okay, yeah. Yeah.
Just for me, your professor doesn't happen in one meditation. It happens like I have to go through multiple meditations, and then some of them, the revelation will be sometimes it happens during my daily life. I will notice that I'm joyful, or I will notice that I'm at peace, but it doesn't happen in meditation only. So is that how the process goes? That's why I'm asking about the process just now.
Yes, indeed, it happens at time, but in daily life, you can't go so deep. You can only go to the joy, but you can't go to the tranquility because your body is too active in daily life. So the meditation, the purpose of meditation is to take that process deeper. So you access the joy, when you access the joy, you take it even to one step deeper. So you're right, the process can happen at any time, and it will depend on the situation, how deep it goes.
Then you would you understand how faith works. I mean, there are different faith happens for reasons, and there are many, many, you know, we see it one point of view, other people will see it at a point of view, and you understand that, and then from there you will dig in and or you will, instead of responding to that situation or that scenario, you will just stand back and you will become comfortable
So you understand your own experience in terms of impermanence, dukkha and anatta. That is really what it refers to here in the Code of Reality. It will also affect your ordinary life as well. It will affect the way you deal with people. But a lot of the practice, ordinary daily practice with understanding is also, in a sense, understanding in the Code of Reality at a much more shallow level. So this has to do with how do we deal with people in ordinary life, as you said, when we have different viewpoints and these kind of things. How do you overcome any kind of anger, any kind of negativity in that thing, so you can stand back more, so you can have more clarity of what is going on. That is a more basic kind of seeing things that go in a good way then. It's not a deep thing that we're talking about here. And I will talk about that sooner, because this actually is a very important part of it. And once you get that blind, you can actually go. There's so many problems in blind here. Yes? I'll talk about that soon enough. Okay. Yes, one more question over here. Okay.
My question is about this disenchantment and depression, right? So is there a danger of developing depression after we are disenchanted?
There is no chance whatsoever. Yeah. The good disenchantment is the opposite. It is the disenchantment with the world. And because you have found so much happiness in the meditation practice, you will get the exact opposite of depression. You'll think, the good disenchantment, the happy disenchantment. So it is just a repulsion from those things that you see as you're coming along there. It's just like, in your daily life, you go to the restaurant and it serves you really bad food. You get really dispassionate about that restaurant. You never want to go there again. You're not passionate about it. But you just take away from that restaurant because it's a Dukkha restaurant. The name of the restaurant is Dukkha. You don't go there again. And that's really what it means. That you're changing your perspective. You're moving towards where true happiness is and away from where Dukkha is. That's why you will not get depressed. If you get to this part of the path, you are beyond depression at this point. Yes. Okay, maybe let's take a break and we'll see you again, I suppose, this afternoon. What should we do? 3 o'clock, I think, this afternoon. Okay, thank you. I have a nice lunch. Thank you.